Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway for Thursday, January 25th, 2018.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Over the last 2 weeks, more than 150 women and girls captured the attention of the country as they stood up in a courtroom in Lansing, Michigan, one by one, and confronted their abuser. On Wednesday, a judge sentenced that abuser, former USA Gymnastics team Dr. Larry Nassar. He'll spend the rest of his life in a Michigan state prison. Presiding Judge Rosemary Aquilina sentenced Larry Nassar to a minimum of 40 years, up to 175 years for sexually abusing seven girls. That comes on top of a 60-year sentence for earlier child pornography convictions. Aquilina said she considered the testimony of every victim, and parents too, like this one.
I willingly took my most precious gift in this world to you, and you hurt her.
That's Anne Swinehart, mother of gymnast Jillian Swinehart, in testimony this week. In addition to addressing Larry Nassar, she also addressed the public.
Quit shaming and blaming the parents. Trust me, you would not have known, and you would not have done anything differently.
What could have been done differently? It's often the question when a tragedy like this unfolds, and it's something our next guests intimately understand. Courtney Keel was a junior elite gymnast on track one day for the Olympics when she was sexually abused by her coach, Robert Schaller, in 2002. To be clear, she was not abused by Larry Nassar. This is an unconnected incident. But today, Courtney is a sexual abuse attorney, and she joins me now alongside her mom, Joyce Keel. And we should warn listeners that this conversation might be difficult for some people to listen to. Courtney, Joyce, thank you for being here.
Hi.
Hi.
Courtney, how did you get started in gymnastics? How competitive was it for you? How big a part of your life was this?
It was my entire life. I started when I was 3 or 4 years old, just taking a regular class like kids do, and fell in love. And I started homeschooling by third grade to practice more and have more time.
What was practice time like by the time you were, you know, 12, 13 years old? How much were you doing it?
A couple, 2 or 3 hours in the morning, and then probably 4 to 5 hours in the evening.
This was your life?
Yes, completely.
Well, Joyce, what kind of a relationship did you have with Courtney's coaches, Robert and Kristen, who would eventually become her abuser and the wife of her abuser?
Well, I would say I thought they were our friends. I mean, at that time, they were our friends. You know, they were kind of second parents to Courtney. I mean, she was spending a lot of time at the gym. So we trusted them. We thought they had her best interest, which maybe they did for gymnastics, but it went a little awry there. It's a little hard for me to talk about when I think about that. It's like we were friends. It was kind of a family there at the gym. I mean, the girls spend so much time together, and the parents get to know each other. It becomes like your family. I mean, she really loved the sport. And for her, working out was what she needed to do because she had goals and she had aspirations of what she wanted to do.
Courtney, if we can I ask you about the abuse, when it started, and to the extent that you want to tell us what happened?
Yeah. The first time it happened, I was 12 years old. It was one of my morning workouts. I had been a little bit sore that day, so I was getting some extra stretching done on my hip flexors, and he started massaging my muscles and had his hand slide up farther and farther until he lifted up my leotard and slid it under and touched my vagina. There were some incidents that weren't quite like that, but it was pretty much that same routine every day.
Every day for how long?
At least a year, until I confronted him about it and I sent him an email and said, I don't want to do these specific stretches with you anymore. And those were the stretches that he would usually abuse me when helping with. So it sort of stopped after that, but it wasn't about another year after that, probably, until I came forward. I really wanted to say something, but I was so scared of losing gymnastics. That's what it was for me. I wasn't scared that my parents weren't going to believe me. I knew they would believe me, and I would have to leave that gym, and everything, my whole world was going to fall apart, and I wasn't ready for that.
Do you remember the moment you decided to talk to your mom and dad about it, and why you did and when you did?
It was January 26, 2004, and I was having a conversation with some of my teammates, and a story about Robert had come up about how he had touched a girl's crotch at some point, and one of the girls sitting at the table hadn't heard that before, and she said, "Oh, well, he did that to me." And then another girl said, "Me too." And then it came around to me, and I said, "Me too." So that was the first time I had learned that there were other girls. And I went home that night just disgusted, upset with myself, brought everything back. And I had a morning workout the next morning, just me and him. And Kristen in the front office, his wife in the front office. And I was starting to do something, and I felt his hand sliding up my leg. And I don't think he was going to do anything, but I squirmed at the top of my handstand. And he kicked me out for having a bad attitude. He said, "Go sit in the locker room until you're ready to come back and work." And I went to the locker room, and my body started shaking, and my breath grew really heavy. And I knew that my mom was going to be walking in, and when I saw her, I was going to have to tell her what happened.
And you told her there in the gym that day?
Yeah, she came over to me, and she saw me sitting in the locker room, and she said, "What's wrong?" And I said, "I have to tell you something, but it's going to make you really mad. You're going to want to leave here, and you're never going to want to come back."
Joyce, from your perspective, walking into the gym, what's your memory?
Exactly that. I saw her sitting on the bench. I thought, oh no, what happened? You know, I thought, oh, maybe she wasn't feeling good. She got kicked out. What's going on? I didn't know. But then I could tell by the way she looked at me, there was something different. And I'll never forget those words when she said that. I didn't know what it was, but I thought, okay, this can't be good. But I think I kind of went into this shock mode a little bit, or protective mode. But I knew whatever she needed to tell me was really important, and that we just needed to go. So we left, and she told me, and I was stunned, but I didn't not believe her. I mean, we immediately called my husband, who immediately came home from work, and we sat down, and she told my husband the story. And as a parent, I was just like, God, I never even saw it coming. I had no idea. No idea. And we're a close family. It's not like we're a family that, you know, we take part in what she's doing. So sometimes you really don't see it coming at all. It's like they cover it up. The girls cover it up because they don't want you to know, and they don't want you to be hurt. And like she said, she didn't want her world to fall apart. I don't wish for anyone to go through that.
You were able to go immediately to the other parents and the other girls. Courtney's peers were talking about this. In fact, they were saying "me too" at that moment.
Yeah.
A phrase that's become familiar.
Right. I mean, that was the day before she told us that that all happened. We didn't talk to the parents. We didn't go back to the gym. We let the owners handle all of that and everything. And of course, you know, just like I'm sure it happens in any case, there are people who said, "Oh no, that could have never happened," and others who like fully supported. And that's hard too, you know, when you think you're a family, and I guess it's like a family. I mean, you get divided, and definitely there's people who support what you believe or what happened, and those who don't believe.
I wonder if watching Michigan State, if watching Penn State over these last months and years, you haven't had sort of a pretty keen sense of institutions and what it can be like when they resist or have their incentives flipped around.
Well, I have to say, for us, at least the gym we went to and the owners, they reacted immediately, which was good. I mean, they removed Robert from the gym. Yeah, I think as soon as someone knows, it's like, I don't understand how they cannot do anything. Even when we were going through the her case and dealing with USA Gymnastics, I remember it seemed like the response was so slow. You know, it's like, these are little kids that are being impacted. You know, do something.
I mean, did telling USA Gymnastics about the abuse, the sexual abuse of children, set off a five-alarm fire over there, in your experience?
I don't know. I feel like maybe they've had that in the past, because they already had a list of banned coaches, which they do have. But, I mean, it took a long time for the coach's name
to
actually appear.
It took a long time for him to actually get on the list, even after we had a conviction.
After a legal conviction, it took a long time.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
That's remarkable.
And maybe the thought there is he's in prison now, so he's not hurting anyone, but he didn't get a lengthy sentence and didn't take long for him to get out.
Joyce, you didn't see the signs. You didn't see it coming. So many times in situations like this, maybe in all of our lives, you didn't see something bad coming. And yet when you look back with the benefit of hindsight, you say, ah, I might have seen it, or I might have known.
I look back and see, how did I not know? Or was I not asking right questions? Or should I have been just staying there the whole time, you know, not leaving? Or how did I put her in that circumstance? Yeah, there's guilt. And even though in reality I know I really didn't see it coming, or I didn't know it was happening. But I think the only thing that I could do at that point was like support her 100%, 200%, you know, to get her the help that she needed and to figure out how to make it stop, you know, so it doesn't happen anymore. There's no way you can't feel guilt, you know, and anger, you know, betrayal. Like, I mean, betrayal, because you thought these people or this person had your best interest, and at the same time were taking advantage, you know, of a little girl. It's wrong.
Joyce, I know you never, ever wanted to be in the position where you could give good advice to parents who might be worried that their children could be going through a similar thing, but you are in that position.
I would say trust your gut, listen to your child. I mean, really, you know, everyone says, oh, have an open communication. I think that's truly the best thing you can do, to let your kids know they can tell you anything and it's okay, and do that gut check constantly. And trust it.
Courtney, you've situated your entire professional life now to helping victims of sexual abuse. You're an attorney. You defend these kids and you help defend their parents as well. I know that you have advice now for kids and for parents who feel like they might be in a similar situation.
Don't be afraid to speak up. I don't ever want to pressure anyone to speak before they're ready, but there are ways out. And I think the most important thing I always want people to remember is that they're not alone. It's the most lonely feeling going through that. But there are so many people out there who have gone through that, and they get through it, just like I have and just like my mom has. And we come out stronger on the other side. We really do.
Former gymnast and current attorney Courtney Keel and Joyce Keel, mom. Courtney, mom, thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
You can call it Star Wars for the America First era. The star in this case, your very own son. The Trump administration announced steep new tariffs on foreign-made solar panels earlier this week.
Our companies will not be taken advantage of anymore, and our workers are going to have lots of really great jobs with products that are going to be made in the good old USA, and that's what this is all about.
Well, the tariffs are aimed at Chinese solar manufacturers, but this latest swipe in the solar trade wars got a swift response from China, from the international community, and from the American solar industry. Madison Freeman is a fellow at the Clean Energy Leadership Institute. Madison, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what do these new tariffs do, and why has President Trump chosen this moment to impose them? What do they hope to achieve?
So these are pretty broad and sweeping tariffs. They apply to almost all imports of solar panels to the United States. And they're pretty steep as well. They're about 30%, and they step down over 4 years to 15%. And the goal of these tariffs is kind of twofold, both to actually support U.S. manufacturing of solar panels through protecting U.S. companies, as well as sort of being more of a symbol to China that these sort of trade practices that enabled really cheap solar panels on the international market aren't acceptable and won't be tolerated by this administration.
Now, this story didn't start this week with the announcement of 30% tariffs. The U.S. and China have traded blows in the solar sector for a long time. Give us a little bit of the history here.
Yeah, so for about 10 years ago, the Chinese government started really aggressively subsidizing solar manufacturing. Chinese companies were then able to flood the international market with really cheap solar panels. And in about 2010, 2011, that ended up really hurting U.S. manufacturing. And so you see in 2010 and 2011, about 25% of American solar production capacity completely disappeared. And a lot of solar manufacturers went bankrupt and closed, and it really damaged our ability to produce solar panels. This happened in both the more traditional solar panels that were companies that were competing directly with China, as well as the new innovative startups that were creating almost entirely different products, but just weren't able to match the below-cost prices of these Chinese solar panels. So the Obama administration imposed tariffs in 2012 and 2014. They were supposed to crack down on Chinese companies and targeted China and Taiwan specifically. But a lot of these Chinese companies just then moved their manufacturing to Malaysia or Thailand or South Korea. And so these cheap panels have stayed on the market at that same price. And what you've seen is that the U.S. Solar industry has shifted from manufacturing to installations. We used to make up about 25% of world solar panel manufacturing, and now we only make about 5%. But we've had a booming solar industry in the meantime, as we've used these cheap panels to fuel sort of a solar renaissance in a lot of places, including California, including a lot of states across the East Coast. And it's been really great for the industry overall, but manufacturing has never jumped back. And so these tariffs are prompted by a case that the International Trade Commission filed by two solar manufacturers who are going bankrupt and were asking for protections against what they saw as unfair trade practices.
But the industry that's boomed in the United States, installation and management, would that industry be negatively affected by tariffs on foreign panels? I mean, if it makes it harder to buy solar panels if they come from China, South Korea, or anywhere else, the people who sell them and install them here in the United States are going to suffer.
So that's exactly the problem with these tariffs, is that the U.S. solar industry has been pretty strongly opposed to these tariffs, kind of across the board, because so much of the industry today revolves around being able to import these cheap panels. And most of the jobs in the solar industry revolve around this. And this is not a small industry. There's about 260,000 jobs in solar, and the vast majority of those are either in installation, the people who come to your house and put the solar panel on your roof and then come back to maintain it, or they're in, you know, associated industries of sales or of financing, of project management. The Solar Industries Association has estimated, kind of on the high end, that this could put at risk about 23,000 jobs, mostly in installation. So there's a large contingent of the solar industry that's really, really concerned about what this will do to their ability to continue growing at the rapid rate that they've been able to in the past.
Is there a legitimate worry in the United States that China will eventually control the entire solar market? I mean, you said U.S. manufacturing is down to 5%. Are we out of the game? Has China already won?
So I think there's a really, you know, clear history of China dominating the global solar market. Back in about, I think, 2005, they were at about 7% of global production. And today they're about at 70%. They really are the primary manufacturer for sort of the traditional silicon solar panel. However, if you're concerned about American manufacturing and you want to encourage American manufacturing of solar panels, the way to do it is not to put these blunt tariffs. They're a really crude instrument for a really complicated and delicate situation. The United States has never been the best at creating the cheapest products, and that's not what our strength is. And China's been able to do that with these solar panels. And I think if we're going to try to compete, we shouldn't try to compete with these traditional panels at the cheapest cost, but instead we should try to compete by innovating. That's been our strong suit for a long time. And unfortunately, these cheap panels did knock out a lot of really innovative startups in Silicon Valley that were creating very different types of solar panels that were much more efficient, that were much more durable, that were able to be implemented in very different ways. If you're worried about jobs, if you're worried about U.S. industry, if you're worried about making sure that prices are cheap and fair for the average consumer, then this doesn't accomplish any of that. All it really accomplishes is sort of making an ideological statement that China has unfair trade practices and we want to have a heavy hand. If you look at this as making a statement or taking a stand against China, I don't think that it actually accomplishes any goals of hurting China, and it certainly leaves us open to a lot more difficulty moving forward.
Madison Freeman, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Madison Freeman is a fellow at the Clean Energy Leadership Institute. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillikin. President Trump delivers his first State of the Union address next week. In the lead up to that American political ritual, all this week, we've been looking at the first year of the Trump presidency and its impact on the nation. Yesterday, we talked about the environment, and today we go to one of the main planks of the Trump campaign, national security. Juliette Kayyem is the former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security. She's now faculty chair of Homeland Security at Harvard Kennedy School. Juliette, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Juliette, the president ran on a platform of security and law and order. Where has the biggest impact of the Trump presidency been in the world of national security, in your view?
In the world of sort of national security, or in fact, protecting the homeland, I'd put it into sort of two major themes under the first year. The first is, who is he against? And so then clearly you look to sort of some of the immigration enforcement issues, the Muslim ban, and other aspects of the sort of policies that are essentially just sort of hardcore on immigration enforcement. The other piece is, who is he for? And I think it's very important to note that over the course of the year, through regulations and some of the DOJ guidelines, some of the checks that had been put on law enforcement in the wake of, you know, their use of military equipment or some of the racial incidents that had happened, that some of those checks have actually sort of quietly gone away. And so you see sort of a push towards supporting law enforcement and isolating immigrants. And it's sort of coming to a play, I have to say, in urban areas. I mean, this is where you're seeing the big conflict. And so how it plays out over time, or whether there's some catalyst moment, we just don't know yet.
How have these policies affected the ability to keep the homeland safe?
Well, they have little impact if you just looked at the data. So America's challenge today, at least in the terrorism issue, right, is clearly either homegrown terrorism not related to Islamic radicalization, or is Islamic radicalization of people who are already here. So this idea of we're going to keep them out may sound politically appealing, but if you just look at the data, that's not what's occurring in the United States. But the other problem is if you're expending resources on the dreamers or the nice doctor or all these cases that we read every single day, you are not expending resources on the people who do terrorize our communities, right? And looking at various risks to the country, whether they're pandemics or climate change. Trump has done another pivot, and that is to view the Department of Homeland Security as solely a border agency. And meanwhile, you know, our cyber vulnerabilities are clearly not being addressed. Climate change is not only not being addressed, it's not even being recognized. All these other things that harm Americans, harm our homeland, are just not even being addressed by the department that's supposed to focus on our homeland security.
Well, for the career people who work in homeland security and work in national security, do you have a sense that they feel like they're still able to execute their mission? Or that what you're describing as an ideologically driven national security strategy is interrupting that for them?
So it's a great question, and it's changed over this last year. When President Trump won, I think there was a sense that that was a campaign, but that governance would be different. And people that I talked to who were going to stick it out and They've all left. And those who stay head down. I mean, in other words, people at FEMA that I know, Federal Emergency Management Agency, dealing with all these hurricanes in Puerto Rico, they are doing what they can do and probably grateful that they are ignored. And I think the area where it's very difficult to be on the fence and to wait it out is areas where who Trump is against, immigrants, and who he is for sort of come into conflict. And I think that's where you're going to see the long-term impact.
Juliette Kayyem, former Assistant Secretary at the Department of Homeland Security and Faculty Chair of Homeland Security at the Harvard Kennedy School. Juliette, what a pleasure. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
The Takeaway is supported by Constant Contact, with email marketing tools that include drag-and-drop editing and customizable templates. Learn more at ConstantContact.com.
Earlier this week, two 15-year-olds were killed and more than 18 others injured at a high school in Benton, Kentucky. The shooting made headlines, and so did the fact that other school shootings haven't. The violence in Kentucky marked the 11th school shooting this year, before the month of January is even out. When you read a statistic like that, it's shocking, but the truth is, comprehensive data on school shootings don't exist in this country. For the number we do know on school shootings, they can be deceiving in this media environment. Julie Weber is professor of politics and government at Illinois State University and author of the book Beyond Columbine. Julie, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the number of school shootings, Julie, there have been a lot lately, and it feels to a lot of Americans like they must be more common than they once were. What are the real trends?
Well, let me say, first of all, I have three main points about this issue. And the main trends are that violence has remained steady for the last probably 10 years, but it had gone down significantly since 1993 when it had reached its height. And so gun violence today is lower than it was in 1993. The second point that I would make is that gun violence may seem like it's going back up. It's steadily going back up, but there tends to be these fluctuations, and those are caused by spikes in gun violence deaths that go into the count. And that makes it seem like gun violence is going up overall. But in actual fact, we're still waiting on these sort of fluctuations to see if they go back down, because they usually do. The third point I'd make is that most gun violence does not occur in schools. It occurs in homes and workplaces. So about 1 in 8 gun violence deaths occurs in schools.
All right. So Julie, the statistics suggest that while violent deaths at school or deadly school shootings are down over the years, overall incidents with guns in the school or on school property are up. Can you pick apart sort of what we know about the numbers and whether violence in school with guns really is up or down?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I think that the incidents, and depending on how we count them, the article in the New York Times yesterday was that there had been 10 shootings since the first of the year, and it was only the 23rd day of the year. But if you break down those incidents, they count a gun going off at or near a school as a shooting incident. And so if we break down those 10 incidents, 2 of them were suicide or suicide attempts, 4 were gunfire going off at or near a school, and 4 were homicide attempts. The gun violence that's happening at schools is not necessarily the kind that we see on the news that is the more spectacular kind of incidents with people going into schools and terrorizing people in confined spaces like the lunchroom and other places. Most of it tends to be guns going off at or near schools, or somebody bringing a gun to school that's unsecured from the home.
Right. I wanted to ask you if there's an important differentiation between the kind of shooting where, say, a student might bring a gun to school to settle a grievance with another specific student versus the mass shooting, the mass revenge, the terrorizing of people in the lunchroom, as you say. Would you distinguish between those in terms of understanding the overall problem?
Absolutely. The first kind you mentioned, the kind where somebody comes to school and it's revenge oriented against a particular person, we call interpersonal violence. That may be what counts for more of these incidents, simply because there's 300 million guns in circulation in the United States. So kids can get a hold of them, and if they have a grievance, they can take it to school and they can attempt to threaten somebody. They tend to end usually without death. But the other kind, I think, are very rare. I mean, maybe there's been 6 or 7 in the past few years. So there's a really big difference between the two types. But what happens is the part stands in for the whole in the media. So these, and in the public's mind, these larger events like Columbine, they stand in for what we see as school violence, when in reality, most of school violence is not as spectacular as that. But I really wish that we would pay attention to the less spectacular versions of it, because those are all too common. And we do need to do something about it as a nation and in our communities. We need to take action against a lot of these smaller incidents, what we call interpersonal violence. And suicide is a really big issue as well.
Julie Weber, professor of politics and government at Illinois State University and author of Beyond Columbine. Julie Weber, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language like Spanish, French, and German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel, Babbel.com.
We have a story now that stretches from the jungles of Colombia to the suburbs of Ohio and even beyond. Illegal gold mining and its effects can be found all over the world.
It's now bigger than cocaine in Latin America, according to government estimates down there. We're talking a $2 to $3 billion a year industry in Colombia alone.
That's Nicholas Neamas. He's an investigative reporter for the Miami Herald, which is out with a new series called Dirty Gold, Clean Cash. It's a deep dive on the illegal gold trade, its connections to the drug trade, and the exploitation that goes along with it. It's all been going on for decades, but illicit mining is starting to get noticed by governments and world leaders. And that includes Pope Francis, who condemned the practice last week during a visit to Peru. Speaking from the Peruvian Amazon, the Pope said the region's gold mining industry corrupts everything. But Nick Neamas says the illegal gold trade is hard to trace, and that to understand it, you have to look to the cartels.
What's really driving this is that narco traffickers and other criminal or guerrilla groups in Latin America have realized that there is so much money to be made in gold, and it's so much easier than cultivating coca and making it into cocaine, as one Colombian source told us. You know, gold is always legal. So it's both being used to launder money and also to generate independent profits. Now, you know, regardless of where the money is coming from, these mines are illegal in the sense that they're, you know, tearing down protected areas of the rainforest. They're using dangerous chemicals like mercury in unsafe ways. They're not following labor laws and, you know, all the various ills that you'd expect from this kind of really devastating strip mining.
So the Miami Herald's report, Nicholas, took you all over the world, or at least all over the Western Hemisphere. Let's start at the source. Let's go down to the Amazon in Colombia, in Peru. Your reporters went there. What did you find?
Yes, so our correspondent, Jim Wiss, traveled to the southwestern part of the Colombian jungle. He, you know, initially he went with a Colombian police force that is really treating this like they treated the drug war, in that he went with them on an airborne helicopter raid into the jungle where they found an illegal mining operation and just packed the dredges and backhoes with C4 explosives and blew them up right there. You know, so there's a very militaristic approach to combat this problem down there. The Colombian government views this problem as seriously as it does the cocaine industry. And in fact, the environmental devastation is much worse. You know, one expert told us it could take hundreds of years for these forests to grow back. You know, meanwhile, it's important to note a distinction between the really illegal mining and then the unlicensed artisanal miners who aren't recognized by the government but have been practicing small-scale river mining for hundreds of years. So these smaller miners, you know, in turn feel attacked both by the government, which is trying to regulate them, and by the cartels and criminal gangs who are extorting them, making them pay protection money. So, you know, these artisanal miners are perhaps in the worst situation of all, not to mention the fact that they suffer from very high levels of toxic mercury.
Well, that's part of the scene in Colombia and Peru. But then the story takes you right to your own backyard, to Miami, where a lot of this gold is filtered through in imports. What'd you find out in your own town?
Yes, so Miami is really unbeknownst to anyone down here, even to me, who was a business reporter for several years here. Miami is the center of America's gold trade because it's so close to Latin America. All the gold, essentially, or, well, let's say a third of the nation's gold every year, the most of any U.S. city, is flown into Miami, and then, you know, some of it is smelted here, and some of it is shipped across the country for manufacture into our jewelry, our smartphones, bullion for investors, and you know, so Miami is really very much at the center of this.
Does anybody really know, of all the gold that comes through Miami every year, how much is legitimate, legal, by the books, the way it should be? And how much is this blood gold, essentially, from Colombia, Peru, other places?
You know, it's very difficult to tell precisely because it's so easy to hide the origins of tainted metal. You know, to give you some idea, Miami imports, you know, say $4 billion worth of gold per year. Last year, federal prosecutors charged employees of one of the U.S.'s biggest gold companies with laundering $3.6 billion worth of dirty gold over a 4 or 5 year period. To look at it another way, you take Colombia. The big legal regulated mines there produced 8 tons of gold last year, but the country exported worldwide 64 tons of gold. So the rest is, for the most part, unlicensed and illegal. So the scale of the problem is really massive.
Well, Nicholas, from Colombia and Peru through Miami, where you're from, to rural Ohio, you went to a refiner there. What did you find?
Well, so this refinery is actually only one of four really, really major big refineries in the United States. This was where the gold that I mentioned earlier, the criminal gold from Latin America, was being melted down by a Dallas-based company called Elemetal. The gold was sourced and purchased through their Miami affiliate, but the gold ended up in this corner of Ohio that's really part of Appalachia. And the influx of gold there created a lot of jobs. When the scandal broke, when federal prosecutors charged the employees of the company with money laundering and industry groups took away the company's certification to trade gold, those jobs were lost. And, you know, this is a seriously depressed area of the country.
Well, let's look at our own U.S. government for just a minute. Gold is a legal product. It will remain legal. It's not policeable the way cocaine was, because all cocaine's illegal. So what are U.S. authorities doing about this?
Well, for many decades, they didn't do a whole lot. We interviewed some former federal agents who kind of discovered the scope of this problem in their investigations, and this goes back to the late 80s and early 90s, and called for the government to really take a stronger regulatory role, and they were told, you know, frankly, that the government was not interested. That is changing very recently, and it comes back to the prosecution in Miami I mentioned of these three metals traders. So the prosecutors and federal agents in general are interested in watching the gold industry more carefully. They're not as interested in the gold, I'd say. They are interested in the infiltration by narco traffickers and other criminals. You know, it's a means to an end in that sense. You know, and I do want to be fair to some of the companies in our reporting. You know, they are trying to make sure that their gold is sourced legally, but at some point it's really impossible just because the gold changes hands so many times before it gets to America, and it's so easy to hide where it comes from. So transparency in supply chains is really, you know, what will help change this problem.
A sweeping investigation by the Miami Herald into the breadth of the illegal gold industry from the jungles of Peru and Colombia through Miami, across America, and across the world. Nicholas Niemas, investigative reporter for the Miami Herald. Nicholas, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Want to bring The Takeaway with you on the go? Subscribe to The Takeaway as a podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks for being with us this hour on The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. As the Me Too movement continues to develop and solidify in American society, what do we make of some of the art and popular culture that suddenly feels pretty outdated? We asked you.
Any movie or TV show that shows a man relentlessly pursuing a woman who has repeatedly refused him or expressed that she has no interest.
Casablanca.
The Rodney Dangerfield movie, Ladybug. I don't really want to watch Louie anymore. Master of None.
The Animal House, The Revenge of the Nerds.
So I feel like I can't enjoy any pop culture at this moment right now. Like, everything I watch is either creepy because of the terminology and the storyline and the language used, or it's creepy because it actually is made by someone now exposed of being a sexual assaulter or sexual harasser, and it's everywhere.
That's Jessica Bennett of the New York Times. Every week, Jessica and Koa Beck of Jezebel join us to talk about gender issues and the Me Too movement. And this week, Jessica and Koa talk about consuming culture and art at a time when suddenly a lot of it might look and sound really different. Like, how about this beloved wintry holiday song?
Neighbors might think,
but baby, it's bad out there.
Say, what's in this drink?
No cabs to be had out there.
So what's in this drink? I ought to say no, no, no. I mean, that is literally the script of a sexual assault. It's packaged in this really lovely, like, warm feeling, nice holiday song.
And has clearly been consumed for a long time as simply that.
You don't even notice in some ways. So I think to some extent, perhaps we are looking at culture that has been around for a really long time and not been questioned so much in new ways. I was flipping through channels the other day, and the film, the Judd Apatow film, Superbad, came on. Slapstick, everyone loves it, funny guys, blah, 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 blah. And literally the entire premise of that film is like two dorky kids getting ready to go to college who want to sleep with women before they do.
I should buy Becca alcohol?
Yeah, it'll be pimp. That way you know she'll be drunk.
How much alcohol will they have to feed the girls in order to get them to be blackout drunk enough to have sex with them?
Slash rape them.
Right.
When you guys are shit-faced at the party, you get with her.
It's everywhere. Are you noticing this, Koa?
My wife makes fun of me for this, but I enjoy romantic comedies because generally speaking, nobody is going to be raped or sexually harassed. But that's not even a statement that I can, you know, completely get behind,
right,
because there are exceptions. There's a number of movies that I've started to watch, and then it deviates into this sort of charming sexual harassment plot, you know, where it's like, here's a woman who has a job, but there's this like really flirtatious guy that keeps bothering her, and then the plot develops. And this is for American films as well as international films, where then it's like the rest of the plot is basically her being sexually harassed, but it's cute and funny, and it gets coded as like a very annoying but, you know, nevertheless endearing plot point, which I also have no tolerance for and don't want to see.
Everything from that to the James Bond films, you know, like the entire premise of those again and again, and not just in the titles of the characters like Pussy Galore, is that he is sort of forcefully getting women to desire him.
I'm not interested. Let's go.
What would it take for you to see things my way?
A lot more than you've got.
How do you know?
I don't want to know.
And in some cases, physically pinning them down after they say no again and again. And then eventually they relent. And that's sort of like how he gets his way.
Now let's both play.
And that's a celebrated cultural narrative. I mean, James Bond is considered the sleekest, most gentlemanly, aspirational cultural figure for men. And I think that's another disturbing facet of this, is that there's women and other marginalized genders consuming this, but what are men taking away from these conversations and these celebrated figures who pin women down after they decline, or who need their boundaries tested? Allegedly, through these narratives. I have been rewatching Sex and the City, and my wife and I were watching an episode fairly recently, and it was the one where Carrie is in the Vogue offices with her older male editor, and he takes her into the accessories closet after she's completed a very difficult assignment, and she's very besotted with the shoes, and he calls out to her, and all of a sudden she turns a corner, and he's in his Versace underwear.
Oh!
What do you think?
Doing?
I'm just showing you these briefs.
Well, don't. Julian, pull your pants up.
Oof, look at you in those Mary Janes.
Stop.
The way that that scene ends is with a very assertive, pull your pants up now.
Pants up! Show some respect. This is Vogue.
She takes charge of the conversation and he relents, which I also think is a very difficult narrative to force in this, and that the onus is truly on her, and that the expectation as a viewer is that Carrie will take charge and end this encounter, which, as we've been seeing across real news reports, not all women are in a position to dictate an encounter like that.
It's interesting because I don't even remember that episode of Sex and the City. Like, it was not memorable to me despite loving that show and having watched it over and over and over again. Like, that must have just seemed so normal. But what do we take away from that? Like, can we just not enjoy pop music or R&B or film? I don't know what I'm allowed to enjoy anymore.
I don't think the answer to this can be as simplistic as we can't enjoy it, but I do think we need to recognize it. And so asking people to develop more complicated relationships with the culture they consume, I think, is well warranted, especially when you consider, as we've talked about in other segments, Jessica, the hands that have shaped this culture, particularly when you see like Woody Allen's archive of films and how he's definitely contributed this entire, what's the best way to frame this?
Narrative of coercion.
Yeah, narrative of coercion, because this is the conversation that I do think needs to happen. If you contribute economically to this opening weekend, or you make a point to give filmmakers these dollars, you are perpetuating those narratives. This is a decision I've made in that I like certain Woody Allen films, but long ago I decided that I would not see Woody Allen in theaters because I do not want him to have my money. and that maybe getting more distance as I consume certain narratives of his while also not giving him my money is a line that consumers need to be more aware of in terms of where your money goes. But I also respect people who refuse to watch Woody Allen films and refuse to even allot him or his creativity any space in cultural conversations or in their cultural archives too. So I think there are a lot of personal ways into this issue that can be impactful, but also be tailored to people's experiences within this issue. I mean, I have women in my life who have been assaulted or harassed and don't engage with whole facets of this culture because they know going in what the narrative is going to be. I also respect that decision.
I think that one thing that's interesting is as so many of these men have fallen from power for roles, as we've talked about before, it is actually women replacing them. And so to what extent will having the women be behind the cameras, the women creating the narratives, the women deciding the nuance of the interaction, the workplace interaction, or the romance scene, or the love scene, actually change the way we see some of these subtleties? I think we have to keep talking about these things. We have to keep pointing it out. Like, it may, in fact, make culture hard to enjoy at this moment in time, but it's important.
Jessica Bennett is gender editor for The New York Times and author of Feminist Fight Club. And Koa Beck is editor-in-chief of Jezebel. They join the program every week, and you can find all of Jessica and Koa's conversations at thetakeaway.org/MeTooMemos.
I'm Jennifer from Colorado Springs, Colorado. About the Me Too movement, it wasn't the Me Too movement that changed my perception of pop culture. It was the moment I became one of the Me Too women and realized how pervasive casual misogyny and casual assault is in pop culture.
This is Wally from Hampton Bays, New York. My wife and I recently watched Casablanca, and boy, my favorite character, Captain Renault, played by the great Claude Rains, just comes off as a sleazeball, taking underage women into the back, using them for his own gains. It did not age well in the Me Too moment.
Movies that I enjoyed in the 80s, and I honestly still quote today, like Animal House or Revenge of the Nerds, include depictions that many would have to agree today are assaults on women. That while titillating then, I now see an entirely different light today.
Hi, this is Peggy from St. Petersburg, Florida. I don't think my perception of our culture has somehow changed, although movies with strong women and with women of color are on the uptick, and I am so glad for that.
Your voices on pop culture and art in the moment of Me Too in America, we always want to hear from you. Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can reach us on Twitter. This is The Takeaway.